Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world, and welcome to another episode of Polar Opposites. That's the PO Show right here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Big T, and as always, I'm joined by my main man, my friend, your friend, soon to be everybody's friend, Mr. Cool Hand Phil. Phil, how are you today, sir?
Yeah, I'll tell you, Terrence, I'm doing a lot better than my bracket is doing. That is for sure.
Oh, yes, it is that time of year, and I don't think you're alone. I think most of the country is suffering from bracket buster-itis after an incredible start to the NCAA tournament this past week. we'll definitely get into that, but first, we'll start this show like we start every single show. As adults, you make plenty of decisions every single day. We're just glad that you decided to spend a little bit of time with us right here on the PO Show. Phil, so much has happened in the past week since we last spoke in NASCAR. Kevin Harvick failed to do the West Coast sweep as he came in second at Phoenix, as Brad Keselowski was able to come in first place. And as you mentioned, in college basketball, the men's tournament began, and it was Upset City on the first day of game. None of the 5-12 matchup upsets that we were all looking for. Instead, this tournament was all about the 3 versus 14, as we had two upsets, as UAB and Georgia State University were able to win their second round games. And in the NBA, it's all over but the crying, Phil. Kevin Durant is hanging them up for the rest of the season due to complications with that injured foot, but that opens the door for Russell Westbrook to continue to clown. In fact, he's notched 10 triple-doubles on the season, but that last one, the 10th one, was recalled by the league. Now, in the NFL, as we get closer and closer to draft day, NFL owners are in huddle sessions right now as we speak out in the Phoenix, Arizona field. It's the annual owners' meetings, and on the table for discussion are several rule changes, most of which are centered around enhancing the instant replay. But that's what you've got going on in the NFL. And also, we talked about it last week, the Minnesota Vikings announced that they would not be cutting Adrian Peterson, that they wanted to keep him on the roster. But Adrian Peterson's representative was quoted as saying that he has no interest in his client continuing to offer his services to the Minnesota Vikings, that it is not in his best interest to stay with the team. So it looks like that situation is headed for gridlock. And in fact, Phil, let's pick up the conversation right there. You know, if you listen to this show at all, you know, typically speaking, Phil sides with the establishment, and I tend to side with the players, the individuals. But in this situation, I don't know, it seems like a toss-up, but I'll pose the question. In this Adrian Peterson saga, who's right and who's wrong, Phil?
You know, I think in this situation, I mean, I would side with Peterson. Now, I think Peterson may be using this whole situation that happened last year as the scapegoat, but I think he wanted out of Minnesota before then. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if you fulfill your contract, which he has, and then you come up for free agency or whatever it is, then if you want to switch teams, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, just like when LeBron went to Miami, I never understood why he got criticized for going to a different team. You know, you can do that. That's part of it. Teams can trade you. or you can sign with another team. So I think he's using that situation that happened last year with the suspension as a scapegoat. And if I remember, was it not the Minnesota Vikings who suspended him, or was that an NFL suspension? Can you refresh my memory on that?
Yeah, the situation was is that he was placed on the commissioner's exempt list, which was a league move. But the part that I think under Adrian Peterson's skin is that, unlike, say, take the Ray Rice situation or other situations that you may have seen with other players, the Minnesota Vikings did not stand behind, if you would. They did not stand behind or beside Peterson. They didn't support him in any shape, form, or fashion. In fact, it was quite the opposite. At first available chance, they tried to wash their hands clean of the situation. But now, after the situation is somewhat blown over, now all of a sudden they're like, oh, you're our guy. We wouldn't want to have anybody else. And I think it's that for lack of a better term, that two-faced nature that the Vikings are exhibiting, I think that's what's got Adrian turned off.
Yeah, see, that's what I was getting at. Because the Vikings did not show him support, I thought it was maybe their decision to, you know, let him to serve out the rest of the year under the, you know, commissioner's exempt list or whatever it was. But I knew that there was not the support from the team, so I have no qualms whatsoever about Adrian Peterson switching teams. I mean, because that will leave a sour taste in your mouth. So I feel like he needs to get out of there. I think both the organization and the player, you know, need a new look, you know, and kind of take a breather and part ways. And, you know, sometimes that happens. I mean, and again, I see both sides of it. In today's society, I mean, if anything happens with domestic violence, whether that's against a female or a child or anything that even smells like that, you know, you have to be careful as an organization. And, you know, it's almost, you know, the Vikings, I can almost see how they handled it correctly, but you can handle it correctly in the public eye, but then behind closed doors say, hey, Adrian, you know, we have to say these things out here just to save face and all this, but we really do support you. But I don't even think he got that pat on the back or, you know, that reassuring conversation behind closed doors. You know, I think there was even times where he said he had not even been in communication with the team during that time. Now, I think there was one story that broke where I think they had promised him, you know, a 2-game suspension or, you know, if he would just come to the meeting, and he didn't. So, you know, some of the blame still, to me, falls on Adrian. If the team reaches out to you and says, hey, you know, let's have this meeting, let's do whatever we want to do to get past this, and he doesn't take part in that process, then, I mean, some of the blame is on him. But, again, that goes back to my original thing. I think Adrian has wanted out of Minnesota for the past, you know, two, three years, whatever it is. So I just think he's kind of using this as a scapegoat, because I think even before the situation came out with him whipping his son, you know, he was supposed to be in talks with Jerry Jones and the Cowboys, and that was supposed to happen. And I think they got in a little bit of trouble with that, because I think during the time that they were speaking, I don't think you're allowed to do that as an owner, you know, try to work on trades. I think it was kind of like in a dead period or whatever it is. I remember, you know, there being a story about that out there, kind of like a recruiting situation. So, you know, I just think it's best, you know, I see the Viking side of it. I see Adrian's side, but I am not going to criticize Adrian Peterson or his agent one bit for trying to get out of Minnesota. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it.
Right. And by and large, that's pretty much where I am. I think that his best days in Minnesota, I think, are probably behind him. And, you know, the sad but true part is the Vikings could benefit from, you know, closing the book on that entire situation, to be quite honest. So the fact that they're trying to hold on to him, you know, it seems I don't know. It seems kind of strange, but I get it. I mean, you know, he's still got 3 years, and I think he's got $13 million due this year. And they obviously don't want to pay that $13 million, but you know what? They're not going to be able to find too many people that are willing to pick up that $13 million either. Not because he's not worth it, not because his skills don't translate or warrant that type of money on the field, but simply because of the circus, the media circus that probably comes with bringing Adrian Peterson on. But again, I fault the Vikings for even creating that this much media coverage behind it. This should have been a situation that happened, that took place, that went to trial, that got thrown out, you know, whatever, that gets dismissed, yeah, and you move on from it. But that's not the case. We're still talking about it, and unfortunately, because, in my opinion, because the Vikings handled it so poorly, that's one of the reasons. Now, the other part of it, the business side of it, and again, I guess you really can't fault them in that regard as well. Of course they're saying they want him to play. Of course they're saying they need him, so they can drive up that asking price should someone come along with a suitable trade. But I think that most other – I mean, unless a team is completely desperate for a running back, and they have no other option, I don't think anyone's making that trade that the Vikings would even agree to. Now, again, as we get closer to the draft day, you know, people are clamoring for those number one picks. You don't know what could happen. Someone might very well give up a first round or a second round pick in order to get Adrian Peterson. To be quite honest with you, that's a worthwhile trade. I mean, if you don't have a running back, and let's not forget the type of runner that Adrian Peterson is. I mean, we're not talking about just an average running back in the league. I mean, we're talking about clearly at least one of the top three backs in the league. The only people that I could possibly put ahead of him, maybe Shady McCoy, maybe DeMarco Murray, you know, Adrian Peterson. I mean, in my opinion, those are the elite running backs. And if you want that style of offense, I think you could see a team gladly give up a first round or a late first round or early second round pick, and maybe some cash consideration to pick Adrian Peterson up. But you know, only time will tell in that regard. And there's very little time left in these owners' meetings, Phil. In fact, I think they close up on that tomorrow. But they've got several rule changes proposed, again, mainly around the instant replay. But one rule that they did all agree on today, Phil, was the owners approved a measure that would allow an independent official to stop play if they spotted a player that appeared to be woozy, or as the players call it, to be stung in a play. And they're referring to this as the Julian Edelman rule. If you recall, in the Super Bowl, Edelman got hit by a Seattle Seahawks defenseman, Cam Chancellor, and he was noticeably shaken up by the hit, did not come out, did not miss the play. In fact, went on to score the game-winning touchdown for New England. But under this new rule that a medical official could call a medical timeout to pull that player off the field at any point in time during a game, had this been in play, I don't know, New England Patriots may not win the Super Bowl. Of course, that's neither here nor there. But what's your take on some of these proposed rule changes?
Yeah, now on the rule that you just spoke on, I had not heard that one. And, you know, I would like to read, you know, kind of get more in-depth on it as far as, you know, if they do stop it for that player, does that player automatically have to exit the game? Or is there like a quick medical check if they find out he is good to go? Is he able to stay in the game, or is he automatically, you know, exited the game at least for one play, or, you know, whatever set time they have to evaluate the player? Have you heard what the specifics are?
Right. It definitely wouldn't be anything quick. The player would come out of the game, and at that point, they would immediately start the concussion protocol. So that takes some amount of time, and the game would not stop necessarily for that.
Wow.
I don't know. I can't tell you.
I don't
you
like
exactly.
this.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, I don't know how long the concussion protocol takes place, but it would definitely be over several plays in a series. But it sounds like you're not a fan of that.
No, I mean, it just sounds like an easy way for conspiracy and controversy because, you know, let's say it's a very good defensive player and, you know, kind of banged up, just kind of limping back to the side. Or back to the play, to the huddle, whatever, and then this referee steps into this independent, what did you call it, independent who?
Yeah, a medical trainer, a medical official.
Okay. But, you know, they come out and remove the player from the game, you know, on a fourth down. Then you come to find out this guy, you know, went to school with the owner of the other, you know, I don't know. It just seems like
right.
that's an easy way when it's up to someone who is not even in the game, just independent, is able to stop the game, remove a player from the field to be checked out. You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That just seems like a lot of controversy, especially if it comes at an important juncture of the game. Just like you said in the Super Bowl. I mean, if Edelman had been removed from the game, then maybe they didn't win the Super Bowl, you know, but if he was able to make the catch and make the play, you know, it sounds like he was probably in good enough shape to do that. So I'm not so sure about that. I had heard that, I thought someone was reporting that the extra point was going to go away, but I hadn't heard any more about that. So I guess that did not get approved, which I probably think that's probably a pretty good idea. And then I heard they've even mucked up more the Dez Bryant rule, you know, the Dez Bryant and I can't even think of the receiver name, Johnson, I think, from Detroit, but where you have to maintain possession of the ball through the catch. I mean, to me, it sounds like they just made it even more hard to understand and to make sense. I don't know. It, you know, where you have to become a runner, I think is what they said, you have to become a runner with the ball. To make it again. I mean, it's still like how many feet is it? I just don't understand why a catch cannot be just simplified down. You know, 2 feet inbounds,
right,
with possession of the ball, and then leave it up to the judgment of the officials. I mean, everything in the game. There's so many that are what we hear as judgment calls. You know, if it's a catch.
Right.
Or if it's pass interference or whatever it is, it's a judgment call. So if a catch is 2 feet in bounds and you have, you know, possession of the ball while the feet are in bounds, then to me that should be a catch, you know, or
right.
I don't know. I mean, to me, when you look at the play, you can tell if someone caught the ball or not. You know, to me it's just simple. If you're falling down
wobbles
and you don't have possession of it and your butt is on the ground, then that's incomplete. But if, you know, your feet are in bounds, you catch it, hit the ground, it doesn't move. I mean, that's the case. To me, it doesn't matter if you're trying to get up to become a runner or whatever. If you have it, you have it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, you don't. But to me, it just sounds like they made it more ambiguous, and it's even harder to interpret now. I mean, I just don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, the only place that I have an issue with their whole catch rule or whatever is when it's a touchdown. To me, any play that results in a touchdown should be an instantaneous event. Just like when the runner crosses the plane. It doesn't matter if he drops it when he crosses the plane. It doesn't matter if he puts it down.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. The instant the ball breaks the plane, it's a touchdown. And I think touchdown catches should be the same way. The minute he's got control of the ball 2 feet down, it's a touchdown. Even if it only lasts for a split second. You know? I think it's retarded to think that a guy can catch the ball in the end zone and then fall to the ground and dislodge the ball, and that's not a catch. That's retarded to me. Because it was a touchdown before he hit the ground.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. I mean, and same thing, too, where you could be in the corner of the end zone, like the front part of the end zone, quarterback could throw it, they could kind of, you know, lean out of bounds and catch it and get their feet in, and it's a touchdown. But the ball never crossed the goal line. You know, so to me, I don't understand how a running back, why can't they just get their foot in, you know, and it be a touchdown, you know, any part of their body. So, you know, there's just certain things I don't understand, but I'm completely in agreement with you on that. It should be instant. You know, just like you said, if the running back reaches the ball over and the nose crosses the goal line and a defensive player knocks it out and they review it, they're going to call it a touchdown because it crossed the goal line.
Every time.
Same thing with the touchdown. If your feet are inbound and it hits your hand, and, I mean, to me, you have to have possession. I mean, for at least a split second. I don't mean it bounces off your hand. But if you catch it as soon as you have possession and the ball stops moving, that's a touchdown. Because that's the same thing that happened with what is his name, Johnson from Detroit. I mean, to me, that was the one.
Megatron.
You know, he catches it, spins on the ground, turns around. It's in two hands. He puts it in one hand and tries to get up with it. He used it, you know, to get himself off the ground, and it squirts out, and they said it's incomplete. I mean, it's like I don't even know how you can interpret the rule that way. So I just wish they could do something different with that. I mean, because I don't know. I just think they overthink these things, and they try to put language in the rule to make it more understandable when they should be taking language out and just say, hey, look, we all know what a catch is. Do you have possession or not? If you do, it's a catch. If you don't, it's a fumble. Let's move on. So, or incomplete.
Right, exactly. And like I mentioned, a large portion of some of those rules that they're looking at is expanding instant replay. And I don't know, Phil, if it's going to help the game or hurt the game. I mean, some of the things they're talking about, coaches can challenge anything except turnovers and scoring plays. Coaches should be able to challenge all penalties. Coaches should be allowed to challenge all personal fouls. I mean, it sounds like on the surface, and don't get me wrong, I've always said, you know, I think it's ridiculous when a call is missed. They make a bad call. Say it's a retaliation type thing. They never see what the first player did. They only see the second player. He gets the personal foul. And I've always thought it was retarded when you know you got on tape what happened, but the ref is on the field making a call that he knows nothing about. The other player is losing his mind, jumping up and down, saying to the ref, "No, you. How do you think I ended up on my backside? I didn't just get down here by myself, you know." But they never call that. So I can understand where that makes sense, that, yes, personal fouls and those type penalties should be able to be reviewed. However, is this going to take away from the game? I mean, we've said it. You've heard it a million times. There's holding on every single play. So if there's holding on every single play, it's reasonable to believe that there is some type of penalty on virtually every play in football, and I just don't want this thing to get out of hand. That, you know, every other time we turn around, that's what's happening. And, of course, one of the rules is that one of the proposed changes is that the coaches get an additional challenge instead of just two, giving them three challenges per game. And so, you know, like I said, I get what they're trying to do to kind of make it a better product on the field, to take some of the, as we were saying, the judgment calls from the refs away from the game. But couldn't this in some ways hurt the game?
Well, I don't think, but, I mean, going back to the retaliation, I agree with that. I mean, and I know they would never do it, but I would like to see, and I mean in any sports, basketball, baseball, football, but if a first player gets hit, to me whatever happens on the retaliation side should just be, you should just be part, you know. But if you initiate a fight and the other person retaliates, to me the person that retaliates should not be punished. You know, because that's just life. I mean, if somebody hits you, you need to protect yourself. Because, like you said, a lot of times that first one gets missed. So, you know, if you know the referee's not looking and you hit somebody, well, I mean, what do you have to lose? You know they're probably going to see the retaliation. But, you know, I see that in basketball all the time where, a player will get pushed to the floor, the other guy will stand up and push him, you know, it'll be a double foul. You know, to me, I think that is ridiculous. And I know you have to have restraint and all that. But I don't know. I would just like to see that change. And I think that would cut out a lot of it if you knew, hey, if I start this fight or, you know, hit someone after the play, I know I'm free game after that, and I'm still going to be the one that's punished. I just think that would take a little bit of that out. But to your point about they can review anything and everything, they can, you know, review a minor hold on the edge, I don't think it would get out of control just because, like you said, I mean, you'd be limited to two or three challenges. I don't think
right.
these coaches are going to waste those challenges on, you know, ticky-tack challenges. I mean, I think they're going to save it for big plays or a pass interference
mm-hmm.
that they know was not pass interference and it was just that egregious. And I just don't think it's going to affect it that much. I think it will enhance the game because you're not going to see some of these crazy calls, you know, on a third and 17, they throw it down the field trying to get pass interference. The referee takes the bait, you know, and bails them out. They'll be able to review that, and the other team will have to punt instead of having a first down. So I think it'll be good, and, you know, again, it won't get out of control. And I really don't think you'll see that big of a difference because I think the coaches
right.
are all about maximizing their opportunities. So I think they're going to save those challenges for plays that really have an impact. And that's really all we care about as fans. You know, we don't want to see
true,
a five-yard
true.
Penalty being reviewed, and neither do the coaches. So I think they're going to save it for big plays, and we're not going to be sitting there on Monday morning talking about, wow, can you believe that call again? You know, it'll take some of that out because we'll be able to fix it in real time.
Yeah, yeah, that definitely. I definitely agree with you in that regard. Now, one thing that we both will have to agree on, this first week of the NCAA men's tournament was unbelievable, and it got off to an unbelievable start with upsets right off the bat. On the first day of games, we had one-point games. We had overtime games. We had last-second buzzer beaters. I mean, you name it, we had it in the first weekend of games. Question on the floor, Phil, though, tell me, in your opinion, though, throughout that first weekend, who is your biggest winner and who's your biggest loser of the tournament so far?
Biggest winner, let me skip that because I think that's a little bit tougher. I need to ponder that, but to me the biggest loser would have to be Villanova. I mean, they did not even make it to the Sweet 16, and I mean, to me it's the biggest loser, you know, because I'm being a little bit petty here and selfish because I had them in the championship game. So I really got to say it's the biggest loser with them being a number one team, and you don't even make it, you know, past the second round. So that is just terrible. In my opinion, the biggest winner, you know, I could probably go Wichita State. I know they're a 7 seed, but for them to beat a school like Indiana and then Kansas, both really storied programs, but with Kansas being a number 2 team from the same state, and what, I don't think these teams have played, what, for 20 years? I mean, has it been that long? So they never get to play each other.
It's been a while.
Yeah, so, you know, Wichita State was just, you know, raring to go and was looking forward to the game, and wow, you know, they came to play, and they're a fun team to watch. I mean, the guard, I can't think of his name, I think it starts with a Z. I was not able to even see the Kansas game. I did see their first game, and just very entertaining. You know, that's the style of basketball that I like to see. So I'm going to go biggest loser Villanova, biggest winner, Wichita State. How about you? Who are your winners and losers from the first weekend?
Yeah, you bring up a good one in Villanova, and it's hard not to pick it. I mean, Villanova, the only number one seed not to make it to the Sweet 16. In fact, Jay Wright's club there, the Wildcats, they haven't made it out of the first weekend for 4 straight years. So that's obviously a black eye on that program. And again, when you're a number one seed and you're the only number one seed not to make it through, it's pretty hard not to consider that a major loss. And as I kind of peruse through my bracket, yeah, that that hands down is, in my opinion, the worst loss that we've seen thus far. Now, I mean, and even more so than some of those early matchups, the 4-13 matchups. 3-14 matchups that we saw. I mean, the Baylor loss could be considered a pretty big loss too. I think the only saving grace to keep them off is the rest of the Big 12 didn't show up either. So I think that was more of an indictment on that conference as a whole, because like I said, nothing went well for the Big 12 that first weekend. So I think I'll ride with you, Phil, on that. I'll give it Villanova, the biggest loser. I like your Wichita State pick. That game, that win over Kansas, man, that has to be their big, you know, to be able to beat your in-state. You can't even call it in-state rival because they never match up. And unfortunately, they probably left such a bad taste in Kansas' mouth. They, even though the fans will want to see it, I don't think that's going to become an in-state rival. I don't think they're going to put them on their schedule anytime soon. But I got to go the biggest win during that weekend. I mean, even though they went out the next round, I got to give it to the young men from Georgia State. And what hurt, you know what, Phil, actually I should have put myself the biggest loser. I mean, being an alumni of Georgia State University, Phil, I picked Georgia State to win a couple of games every time they make it to the tournament. Now, they've made it. Here in recent years, they've been making it more frequently. But this is the only year, Phil, pick Georgia State to win at least one game. So I really should be the biggest loser. But I will give my homeboys there the nod on the biggest win. That win over Butler was impressive. And the play of the young man, the coach's son, not just right. in that game, but even in the play-in game to get there, I thought, you know, as far as a two-game run, he probably had as good a game as anybody in the tournament for those two games. Of course, it wasn't enough as they got to the next round. Xavier was just a little too much for him. But that right there, and that kind of set the tone. That was pretty much set the tone for the weekend, Phil. That was the first big upset that, you know, like I said, it kind of set the tone for the weekend. But this weekend, with the Sweet 16 field already set, there's definitely some games, some unbelievable games coming up. I would like to say, I know you'll be, I think the games that that people want to see, I would have to say that Wisconsin-UNC game will be well-watched. The UCLA-Gonzaga is an interesting one because UCLA, in my opinion, let's be honest, had it not been for the bad call, should even be there. But that's neither here nor there. The Duke-Utah, Oklahoma-Michigan State, that's a big one. And the North Carolina State-Louisville, those are both ACC teams. That's a big one. Oh, you know what? But the biggest of them all, I don't even know how I missed this, the biggest of them all, is going to be, of course, Kentucky, West Virginia. Strictly because, Phil, Bob Huggins, coach of West Virginia, has a really, really good win-loss record when he goes up against the Calipari coach team. Huggins has beat Calipari the 10 times that they faced each other, 8 out of the 10 times they faced each other. So, there's reason to believe that Huggins knows a little something about how to beat a Calipari coach team. And because the Mountaineers are so deep, I mean, they play a 13-man rotation, Phil. So they're bringing fresh legs in all the time, all game long, which has really been Kentucky's hallmark in terms of being able to beat people. So it bodes to be pretty interesting. When you look at the history that these two coaches have when playing each other.
Yeah, and if you look at all the 8 games of the Sweet 16 round, the team that has the highest percentage chance to win is Kentucky. I mean, I think they're like a 93% chance to win,
yep.
And I just don't agree with that. You know, there are times where the experts get it wrong. I think that's going to be a good game. And, you know, it goes back to our conversation last week when, you know, you were saying I wasn't giving Calipari his due, and I always have. I feel like giving him his due for what he has earned, but I don't think he's a good X's and O's type coach. I think he just has better athletes, and they can go and win it on their own. It doesn't matter who's on the bench. Now, he was the one that was able to get them there, but I think there are teams that they can run into that Calipari will get out coached, and a team that doesn't have as good of talent can win. And I think West Virginia is a team like that. I'm not saying that they are going to win, but I don't think I think they have better than a 6 or 7% chance of winning this game. I think they like to get up and down the court with the basketball. Now, they're going to have to get back on defense because Kentucky is so big. You know, if you don't get back, then you're just going to be giving up dunks if you're trying to run up and down the court. But I just think Huggins, as you mentioned, I think he knows how to beat that style of basketball. I mean, was Huggins the coach at Cincinnati with, what was it, Kenyon Martin? Is that who I'm thinking of, or is
Correct.
That a different coach?
Correct.
Okay.
No,
so, you know, he's always
him.
Had, yeah, that style of play. So I think they can pose a couple of problems for Kentucky's basketball team because those guards are so good. They're not very big, but they're good. And if they can penetrate on you, and I think they shoot the ball well too, but if they can penetrate and make some of those bigs come out and then dish it, you know, either outside or across the lane, I think they could get some easy baskets. So, but, I mean, you are so right about these games coming up. I think I'm more excited about these, this round of 16, than I was the first two rounds. Because, again, Kentucky, West Virginia, I have to watch that. Wichita State versus Notre Dame, I think that's going to be a very good game. To me, those two teams play a similar style, so I think that'll be a fun game that kind of goes down to the wire. Even the Xavier in Arizona, or – as my dentist calls them, Javier. Javier versus Arizona. I mean, that could be a good game. But, man, I'm telling you, you know, Gonzaga, UCLA, I mean, there is just every single game I'm interested in. So hopefully I'll be able to catch most of them, if not all of them. But, yeah, I'm really excited. To me, though, the thing that's missing from this tournament, that there hasn't been just a big player to step up or – even a no-name player to step up. Like, you know, you remember a couple of years ago when Steph Curry just had his run.
Yes.
You know, and I went back
yes.
on YouTube and watched the highlights. I mean, and I remember how special it was watching at that time, but I'm watching the highlights and I'm giggling because I'm thinking, God, this guy was so good. I mean, it just didn't make any sense. But to me, there hasn't been a player yet that has just stepped up in this tournament where you're like, okay, I have to tune in and watch this guy. And you know, the kid from Georgia State, I think he was on his way to being that. I think it was an RJ.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
just hasn't been somebody that's just taken over this tournament, and I'm kind of surprised. But maybe somebody will step up in the Sweet 16 and just give us a performance that, you know, we'll be talking about for the next few years.
Yeah, and I think this is the round where that said player could step in. Kaminsky, the big 7-footer with the soft touch shooting. Look for him to have a good weekend. He could be one of those breakthrough players. Of course, when you've got the undefeated Kentucky, any number of their starting five could be that, whether it's Collie Stein, whether it's one of the twins. You can find something there. You know, you talked about Notre Dame. Special team they are this year, one of the few teams to beat Duke and North Carolina twice in the same season. Notre Dame was able to do that and win the ACC. So that's saying something. I mean, you win the ACC in basketball, that's like winning the SEC in football. So Notre Dame is definitely a force to be reckoned with, and I think Wichita State's going to have their hands full when those two match up. So you called it right there. That'll be a good game to watch, too. And then when we come back this time next week, we'll be talking about an unbelievable Final Four weekend that's going to be set up. And it's interesting
it's interesting to see just who will come out victorious in those games, who will be the last man standing. Now, as far as in Oklahoma City, we know who the last man standing is. It looks like it's going to be Russell Westbrook. He looks like he's going to be the only starter to make it throughout the season. Serge Ibaka is out for several weeks due to injury. But the bigger news, the bigger name, was that reigning league MVP, Kevin Durant, they're shutting it down because of complications with the foot that he had surgery on during the offseason. Not being able to heal, not being able to get the proper rest, and they're just going ahead and shut him down, more of a precautionary measure than anything else. So that leaves Russell Westbrook an opportunity to kind of continue to do his thing and continue to do to be the man. But here's the question on Oklahoma City Thunder. Phil, and you got to go back a few years. I want you to go back when they first came on the scene, when they had a young James Harden coming off the bench as a sixth man. They had a high-energy yet high-turnover-prone point guard in Russell Westbrook, and they had a silky shooter that could do no wrong in Kevin Durant. And then you fast-forward to present times, James Harden has gone on to bigger and better, greener pastures there in Houston, and they've added some ancillary pieces, but still, Westbrook, Durant still remain in OKC. Given the talent that that team has had, have they underachieved?
Whew, man, I would say no. I mean, they have made it to the finals. Is it just once, or have they been there twice? I know they went once and were beaten by the Heat.
Yeah, bad.
And yeah, I think it was with five games. But that was just the year. I mean, the Heat were kind of, I don't know, just kind of taking over that year. But the West, to me, the West is just loaded with talent. I mean, you're playing with, you know, we talk about the Heat. The Heat can't even handle the Spurs, you know, last year. And, you know, so they're playing in that same division. The Clippers, you know, to me, they're loaded out there in L.A. The Lakers, it's like pretty much the Lakers are the only team that's down, but everyone else is up. I mean, the Clippers, Golden State, like I mentioned, the Spurs. So, you know, it's just all these teams out there are great talent. So it's really no surprise that it's hard to make it out of the West right now. Now, if you'd asked me this, you know, 5 years ago, if they'd have had that team five, six, seven, whatever years ago, then I probably would have said, yeah, you know, they're probably underachieving because I just don't think there was that many good teams. Now, some of the best teams came out of the West, like the Lakers or whoever, but I don't think all of the teams out there were as good as they are today. So I'm going to say no, I mean, because I think they've accomplished a lot. And, you know, if it hadn't been for some of these injuries, I think they could accomplish a little bit more. I don't think they'd be in seventh or eighth place or wherever they stand right now. I think they'd be having a little bit better year. So I'm going to say no, but, you know, I could see how somebody would say that because of all the talent that you've had and, you know, those guys leaving like James Harden and having so much success, and he was on that team with two other All-Stars, and now James Harden is up for, you know, MVP discussion. So I could see it either way, but my answer, me personally, I would say no. I think they've accomplished – quite a bit, even though it may not be a championship.
Right, and you're probably right. It's a young team. It's a young franchise. We're not talking about a lot of history since they've been in Oklahoma City. So in that regard, you're right. They have accomplished a lot. And maybe underachieved is too harsh of a phrase. Maybe what I really mean is that they've let too many opportunities slip by. And that's where my disappointment comes with this team. You know, as you mentioned, you know, they were hot at a time when the Lakers were down. That right there in and of itself is an opportunity for the next dynasty, for the next team to seize the upper echelon of the Western Conference, but they couldn't do that. They let a talented James Harden get away for nothing. I mean, what they got in that trade was nothing. You know, imagine if they could have bit the bullet and just paid him the money that he wanted. And And, you know, and I don't know. You know, I don't remember what the numbers were. I do know that deal he got in Houston was huge. That first contract was enormous. But, you know, but that's an opportunity, you know, that falls on the front office, not being able to keep the team together. And I'm not saying it's an easy feat, but, again, that's what you're charged with. I mean, if you're a front office executive, you're charged with being able to keep the best players on the floor, and you let a James Harden escape and get away. And then with all the injuries, and listen, I understand, you know, that's part of the game, but they've just had, you know, Westbrook, then Durant, then Ibaka. I mean, it's every postseason, or not even the postseason. It seems like it's right before the postseason every year, one of their star players goes down, and, you know, you look at a Popovich, he doesn't have that problem. I mean, yeah, he employs this notion of games off and rest without injuries, so forth and so on. So I feel like even if I don't use the term underachieved, I do feel like they haven't seized the opportunities that were around them to take that team to the next level. And I think the window is closing, which is why that window has closed. I think at that point you will have to say they underachieved, because if in fact another one of the stars leaves, and we talked about this briefly the previous week, whether it's Westbrook going out west, because he is a West Coast guy, or whether it's Durant being pulled to the big city by his big city sports agency, Roc Nation, you know, if either of those things happen, Phil, you can't call it anything but an absolute failure. And I liken it unto the to the Kentucky Wildcats, Phil. They're 36-0. It's a phenomenal run, a phenomenal season. But you and I both know, if they don't win it all, it'll all be for naught. It'll be a wasted season. It'll be a travesty. It'll be a shame if they don't win it all. Just like that Patriots team that went 16-0, unbelievable success, and they lose in the Super Bowl to an unlikely foe in the New York football Giants, and no one's ever talked about that team again. When was the last time you heard anybody say anything about the Patriots going 16-0? Because once they lost in the Super Bowl, it was all for naught. It was a wasted season. And that's how I feel about OKC. If they can't get a championship out of this roster as it is now, they would have clearly have underachieved.
Well, if Kentucky loses, I'll tell you what it'll be. It'll be you telling me that I was right again, because that'll prove my point that Calipari.
Oh.
You know, and that's the thing. I mean, I didn't realize that I think it was Bob, or is his name Bob Huggins? Dennis? What's his name? Okay, so
Bob.
I didn't know it was his team at West Virginia that beat them in the Final Four when he had John Wall and all those superstars.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
right? Was that one of his – that was his first year, I guess, because I think John Wall was supposed to be going to Memphis, but he switched his commitment so he could follow Calipari to Kentucky. So, I mean, but, you know, he beat that team in the Final Four, you know, and they were so good. So I think it's possible that this Kentucky team does get beat before then, but I think this team is better than that John Wall team, because this team does have a little bit more experience with, you know, Cauley Stein staying another year in Towns and all these guys. But back to Durant. Now, yeah, and I heard that same story, too, that was the first time I heard that, where they said Oklahoma City may lose both Durant and Westbrook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hadn't really heard that. You know,
mm-hmm.
when we kind of discussed, it was like, okay, they're going to have to choose between one or the other, but, you know, we didn't think that both guys would be back. But they're saying now, I mean, that both guys may lose, you know, that Durant is, you know, just kind of tired of the media out there. But, you know, I hate to tell him, there's media in every city, and they all write pretty much the same things. But Westbrook is, you know, more probably suited for a big market team, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they could lose both guys. Now, if they do lose both, I mean, I think they would have enough money. They may be able to get some other big names in there. But I don't know, man. I just thought that was crazy. If that does happen, then, yeah, I'm with you. That's going to be one of the greatest failures ever, you know, if they blow the team up in that manner and they really don't have much to show for it. Yeah, that I would change my position at that point.
Yeah, it would be a shame to see, especially for a small market city like that, a team like that, because they may have the money to, but I don't know if you can attract some folks to Oklahoma City. You know, I don't know if you're going to attract some big names to Oklahoma City, and they don't have big name rosters. They don't have a big name coach. I mean, why would you go to Oklahoma City? So I hope and pray, you know, that because, you know, a lot of people look at Kevin Durant as being a lifer, a Reggie Miller type that plays for one team his whole career. And they want him to be that guy because he's clearly the face of the franchise. I get all that. But I honestly feel like this season, and maybe the previous season has led up to it, but I think this season has wore on Durant more than that he's letting on, to the point where he wants to be gone. That he wants, you know, his team, because quite honestly, it's not his team anymore. And I know that sounds crazy to say it, but it's not. Westbrook has came on like gangbusters and caught him with his pants down, so to speak, with all the injuries that Durant has had, and he's been able to take over the team. And he hasn't quite taken over the city yet. Like I said, he still gets a lot of flack because that is Durant's town, but it's Westbrook's team, and that's why I don't think they can coexist anymore for that reason alone. It's Durant's town, but it's Westbrook's team.
No, I agree with that, and I think it has. I think some of that has just been festering with the attention that he has been getting, especially with his play. But again, I go back and I just, even though his play is very good on the stat sheet, I just don't know if it's equating to as many wins as what you would like to see, you know, if you're putting up those type of numbers. And again, it goes back, I didn't realize every time they show a stat, man, it's always about Michael Jordan. And I think
right.
Westbrook had, you know, however many, you know, 9 triple-doubles and 18 games or, you know, something crazy like that. They showed who was the player to have more, you know, in a stretch like that. And Jordan had 10 out of 11 games. And I was like, how do you do that? But you know, Jordan was winning. So to me, that's what's so impressive is it seemed like Jordan always did what was, you know, best for the team, and it would equate to wins. But, you know, Westbrook's play, I mean, they're still sitting in the same place that they were 3 weeks ago, you know, so it just hasn't really caught them, you know, a lot of ground. So, I mean, they could still miss the playoffs, you know, the way we stand now. So, I don't know. I think you kind of need to put that in perspective. You know, now, if he goes to a bigger city, then, again, it goes back to that same argument. I mean, people are going to pay money to see him play. So, even if you're not winning, you're still making money. And you know, that's what the owners want to do. But I just don't know if he's the guy that can lead a team to a championship, because I don't know if he can do what it takes to win. I think he's just all about, hey, I want to go out there and have fun and score points and, you know, do all these different things, which that may not be the recipe for success. So I'm just curious to see if he can evolve as a player and do what's needed to win games instead of just do what is fun to do or what is, you know, I guess his instinct. But, I mean, he's a great player,
right.
great talent. But I could see a player like Westbrook going out and playing for the Lakers. I mean, that's to me, that would be
right.
a team that, you know, you could just see, wow, he looks like he was made to be in a Lakers uniform. But I don't know, I mean, just time will tell if they lose both those guys. But, man, that would be absolutely nuts if they did, because back to what you said, who are they going to get to come and play, you know, because you want big-name guys. Durant's a big-name, MVP last year. Russell Westbrook is the talk of the town, and I mean town as in NBA talk. So,
yes.
But who are you going to get? What big-name are you going to get to come from New York or Chicago, mm-hmm. or, you know, one of these big market teams that say, yeah, let me play for OKC. Even if the money is right, it would just be probably a big culture shock.
Yeah, no doubt about that. But you're right. I mean, Westbrook is, when it's all said and done, he's probably going to go down as one of the league's great point guards. And as he kind of takes center stage, another one of the league's great point guards kind of fades to black, with Steve Nash deciding to call it a career this past week. Of course, two-time league MVP, back-to-back league MVP with Phoenix, and then, of course, won a championship in Dallas. The question here was, Dirk Nowitzki made some comments about the retirement of his ex-teammate, saying that Steve Nash had overcome being slow, being unathletic, and being white to be one of the league's best point guards. In fact, he is number three on the all-time assist list behind Jason Kidd and John Stockton. So, Phil, those comments by Dirk that Steve Nash was able to overcome being unathletic, being slow, and being white. those comments on point or out of line?
No, I mean, I think those guys have a good relationship. I mean, if a black guy had said that, yeah, that might be viewed a little bit different. But with Dirk saying it, because, I mean, really, I think what Dirk is saying, he's saying the same thing about himself. I mean, I think Dirk has overcome, you know, being a little bit on the slower side. But it is. It's incredible mm-hmm. that what Steve Nash was able to accomplish. To me, he's kind of like a Steph Curry. I mean, I think Steph Curry is more athletic, but the way that he can get his body into position to get the shot off, you know, like that one leg, you know, runner shot, kind of scoop shot to kind of get out ahead of the player instead of trying to go up where, you know, they have time to catch it out of the air, you know, with the blocked shot. But he was just so savvy with the basketball. So it really was impressive to see what all he was able to accomplish. Like you said, back-to-back MVP. So, yeah, I don't think there's anything out of line with that. I mean, I think he was probably saying it tongue-in-cheek, and I think he's probably admitting that he has a little bit of those same afflictions, you know, if you watch him play. But, you know, he has that fadeaway, and he can make it, and, you know, he's having a long career too. I don't know, has Dirk ever won MVP? I don't know if he ever won that, but, you know, with the finals and the performance that he put up against, you know, LeBron and Dwayne Wade that year, I mean, he absolutely took those guys to school. And, you know, they had no answers.
Yes,
but and you just can't explain it, because that's the thing. I mean, like Larry Bird, you know, you go back and watch, you know, Larry Bird was that same guy. You go back and watch those games, and it's like, how is he getting his shot off? I mean, you cannot understand, you know. I know he would take it back behind his head and shoot, but it's just like, how? Because they know he's going to shoot a three-pointer, and he's still able to get it off. And some guys just have that knack. But, yeah, I just think he was probably joking. And, yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with those comments. I think he was just giving his buddy a hard time, just like you do me all the time. I don't know why you pick on me, man. I don't get it.
Yeah. But, well, you know what, I will. When I first heard the comment, I was a little taken back from the outset. But I guess I will tend to agree with you as I kind of reflect and look back on it. Had it have been anybody else saying it, particularly had it have been a black player saying it, I think you're right. I think it definitely would have been you know, something that you'd had to take a look at and be like, whoa, wait a minute, where did that come from? So I agree with you in that regard. But I apologize, I misspoke. You know what, he did not win a championship in Dallas.
No.
He matter of fact, yeah, he actually never did win a championship, but he did have the back-to-back MVPs in 05 and 06. Me and you had a separate conversation talking about Larry Bird, talking about he kind of played with a little chip on his shoulder because he felt like he never got the same respect that Magic had because he was white. And apparently, now obviously I wouldn't know anything about it, but apparently that's a real thing in the NBA and to some degree even in sports. I mean, because you could hear the Julian Edelmans and the Riley Coopers of the world, they don't quite get the same respect that, say, a Calvin Johnson or another receiver from another team. And they will tell you it's because they're white and that the guys that's defending them or the guys that's supposed to cover them don't take them serious because they're like, well, this white guy can't shake me. And in fact, that was, Larry Bird in that documentary they did years ago, Bird and Magic, they actually had a conversation about that. So, like I said, at first I was kind of taken back by the comment, but in retrospect, and you bring some light to it, with it being Dirk, former teammate, and then I had to recall, I actually heard players talk about it. That is a real thing amongst elite white athletes, particularly in basketball, more so than anywhere else, but you're starting to see it come in football because, nobody takes the white running back serious. The Toby Gerhardt of the world, they don't quite get the same appreciation that, say, Adrian Peterson would. And like I said, I wouldn't know anything about it, but apparently that's a real thing. So, I think the comments were – go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think a white running back, let's say they led the league in rushing. I know Peyton Hillis did that a few years back,
mm-hmm.
But then he didn't mm-hmm. back it up with anything. So I think that's why these players, I don't think it's because of their skin color. I think if Peyton Hillis had, led the league in rushing and then the next year come back, and even if he didn't lead the league, but if he was in the top three or four and then the next year did it again, I think he would be – regarded as a great running back. But the next year,
mm-hmm.
I don't even know, if he was still playing in Cleveland. I mean, he just fell off the face of the map. So that's why you don't get, respect. You can't be a one and done. And then these other
right.
guys, there are black players in the league that are not as respected as Edelman, but are that same size
mm-hmm.
and stature. But if you had a guy that was like Megatron but was white, well,
right.
Everybody would be
mm-hmm.
talking about it. I mean, let me ask you this. Do you think J.J. Watt gets respect? Heck yeah, because that dude's a beast.
Oh,
so nobody's
doubt.
Like, oh,
mm-hmm.
well, we're not worried about that number 99 on the edge. Heck yeah, they're worried about it. I mean, that guy is one of the greatest game changers in the league, and so everybody
mm-hmm.
respects him, but that's because he backs it up, every year, every game. And it's to me, it's the size. I mean, Wes Welker is never going to be as respected as, one of these big receivers that can really stretch the field. Now, he has a knack, and
right.
I think there's been years where he has led the league in reception, but it's because you can't triple-team a guy like that, because he's cutting through the gaps, and they're hitting,
mm-hmm.
Hitting him on the slashing route. So, it's just kind of hard to defend, but that's why you don't get the respect. I don't think it's necessarily the skin color. So, if Larry Bird said that, I mean, to me, I think Larry Bird did get respect, and I think he was as respected as Magic. And if you hear anybody talk about the game, doesn't matter if they're white or black, usually Larry Bird is mentioned right up there as one of the greats of the game.
Definitely.
So, but sometimes you have to do that. I mean, you hear players that say, I took this flight and turned it into motivation.
Yeah.
Even if that flight was made up in their head, that's what you have to do. So I think Larry Bird, if he looked back now, he would probably admit, he probably was respected, but you have to do that and tell yourself one thing, to get the most out of yourself.
Certainly, certainly, certainly. And there are a lot of players that take that bulletin board material to fuel their whole careers. But you know, there's a group of young men, though, that sometimes you can take it as bulletin board material, and sometimes you just got to take it as the truth. And I think the individuals that participated in this year's the first and probably the only Veterans Combine, Phil, you know, we speculated about what this would all be about and when did this come about. Well, the way I understand it, the Veterans Combine has come and gone, and it was less to do about players, teams getting one more look at a player and more to be about proving to these individuals that they will never make it in the NFL. I know it sounds cold and I know it sounds cruel, but I heard a reporter that was there at the event say that for the first time, he said he saw people just really take a good look in the mirror and realize that their dream of being an NFL player was over, that they were never going to make it. And I heard an ex-player say, why would I go to a Veterans Combine? These guys have already seen me on tape 150 million times. There's nothing that I could show them at this combine that they don't already know about me. And that's when it kind of clicked. I was like, you know what? He makes a good point. This was really just almost like a cattle call to round them all up in one place and be like, forget about it. You're done. So, yeah, I don't think there's going to be a Veterans Combine anymore, Phil. That was just a cruel, cruel joke.
No, I mean, that is hilarious. I didn't even think about that in that respect, but, I mean, that is hilarious. I mean, because you have to know that that's true. You know, if you haven't been picked up the last 3 years, what do you really think they're going to see out of you this year? They're like, oh, man, yeah, we need his services. No, I mean, it is done. But that is a mean trick. You know, it's kind of like asking that girl to prom that you know you're not going to go with and you just stand her up. It's like, that's what they're doing to these cats. They're just saying, hey, show up, put your dress on, you know, get looking all pretty, but we're not going to show up for you.
And the worst part is they probably told their friends, told their wife, their girlfriend, hey, you know what? You know I'm got invited to the combine. You know I'm about to get signed.
Man.
Well, look, folks, that's going to do it for this week's show. Definitely been fun putting this together for you. We'll be back to do it again next week. If you like what you heard tonight, feel free to look us up on iTunes where you can hear this show and all others. And, hey, if you need a fix between now and then, check us out on the World Wide Web at POShowRadio.com where you can find all the latest news in sports and even have an opportunity to listen to this show again. You've been listening to the PO Show, Polar Opposites, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Good night.